3rd, 1978, and we are in his office at the top of Van Hyatt. This is Laura Smale.
Just testing to find out how this sounds at this point. Well, you see, I wanted to start really from the beginning, related to buildings.
Yeah.
And I noticed, though, that one question I haven't seen you answering where is why you came to the university as a graduate student.
Well, I had a professor at University of Maine who had a PhD from here, who had studied law at Columbia. Then in the end, the Depression came on, he went up to Maine as an instructor. Very quickly became chairman of the department, or acting chairman or something, and then decided he needed a PhD, and came here and got it, went back there. I admired him very much, and then so as the war drew to a close, I had to make some decisions, so I applied to Harvard and Wisconsin, got offers from both, and decided for what I want to do, I'd come here.
Well,
good thing I did, because I probably would never survived at Harvard and all that intellectual climate was so strenuous.
It would be interesting to have you talk sometime about the School for Workers.
Oh, I'd be glad to. I've got some stories I can tell about that.
Well, do you want to do that now? I don't know much about it,
Well, yes, let me...
Why don't you?
Well, I came here as a graduate student in fall of 45, stayed that year into the summer, then went back to Maine to a teaching position I had there, which some other time I'll tell you how I got to that. See, most things happen to me is just luck of the damnedest kind, and I'm not being modest. People think I am when I say that, but it's a whole series of chance events. But anyway, I went back, and the department needed a person in labor relations. And after much discussion, they offered a position to a very distinguished man. Philip Taft was at Brown, who had worked earlier with Perlman on Perlman and Taft, Volume 4 of the Documentary History. He's one of the most probably prolific writers in. He died about a year ago after retiring from Brown. Because of some arguments with one or two people in the department or something, anyway, he elected not to come. Then the department decided they'd start with some very young person rather than the senior established person. So they asked me if I would come back, even though I didn't have a degree. And I came back and as an instructor in fall of 47, and then I guess I took my prelims in 48 or 49 and wrote my taught full time, wrote my thesis, and got my degree in 50. The School for Workers had been established in about 26. With the prime mover of the YWCA, a school for working girls, and they attracted from the garment industry, LGWU, and two or three years some men's trade unions said that this was sex discrimination, what about men? So it broadened, and somewhere along the way, after a while, Ernest Schwarzstrauber became director of it. Ernest was a devoted socialist of the Norman Thomas School. He tended to attract socialists to the staff, and they ran it when it was going along, and in 48 or once or twice I went out and gave classes for them. I mean, on an individual basis, I never taught a course, didn't pay much attention to it. But Ernest was getting near retirement, he wasn't well. And he brought in a man named Ulrichsen, older man, must have been 15, 20 years older than I was, who was a trade unionist in Minneapolis, a splendid person, came down to do graduate work, and he wanted to be an assistant, but the only thing available was to be an assistant in the School for Workers. Well, Vic took hold there. His wife had died. He was a widower. And began and really ran the place. But they had recruited two or three fairly militant young socialists. And the School for Workers wasn't as accepted as it is now. And so one of them,
around the
state, on the campus, they try to keep themselves separate. We have to be with the university, but you know, we really are something else kind of attitude. Their offices were in an old building over where the psychology building is now, and behind was a coal pile there then. Well, one of these young people, I guess I won't mention his name, but he, because he's now a professor somewhere, and it's like all of us, he's grown old and more conservative or careful or whatever. Times have changed anyway. He took delight in going out in the state and in the classes denouncing the employers and saying things about them. And of course they had people in the classes who would go back and tell them. And so Mr. Fred was president. Mr. Fred got some heat on this and called. And so we called Ulrichson in one day. Remind you, this is my version of what happened. Everybody has his version, but I think I'm fairly accurate. And Mr. Fred wanted to defend the School for Workers. You see, and Mr. Fred was a great defender of academic freedom. Tremendous. The things he did with very conservative people, marvelous. You know, we got through that whole McCarthy period with not touched here because of Mr. Fred, primarily. But he seemed to be bumbling, but he never bumbled once in his life. He always, I know exactly what he was doing. The old, you know him?
Yes, I've met him.
Yes. Don't be deceived.
Don't
be deceived.
No, I understand it.
Yes. Well, anyway, he wanted the material to defend it. But Ulrichson thought he was being critical. And so Ulrichson denounced him for being reactionary and went pretty far. The story I have, I wasn't there. And at this point, it was so bad that the decision was made by somewhere that, my God, this fellow was not going to be the next director, which he should have been. And by every standard, Ulrichson should have been the director of the School for Workers. So when this became clear, Ulrichson announced that they weren't going outside the state and bringing a director, because he would go to the trade unions and they'd all boycott it, and that would be the end of the School for Workers. Well, of course, that would have suited a lot of employers in the state at that time, but it didn't suit Ed Witte and Sally Perlman and Nate Feinsinger and Bob Fleming, who was here as director of the new Industrial Relations Research Institute. So they decided that something had to be done, so they put the finger on me to go over there and run that thing. And so on a half-time basis, but it was night and day, I became the director of the School for Workers. Wonderful example of the completely unqualified. Ulrichson was very cordial. We'd been friends. He knew it was a mistake. He took me around, introduced me to the labor people, and the introduction was standard. This is Ed Young. Ed is a pretty good fellow. He doesn't know anything about workers' education. It was absolutely true. There's no way of contradicting it. He sort of maybe half hoped that the labor people say, well, we can't deal with that. But they all rallied around. And this is when I made lifelong friends in the labor movement in the state. And because of Feinsinger and Witte, and they agreed to give me a chance. So that's how I got into the School for Workers. And of course, Ulrichson wasn't very happy, as you can understand, very understandably. Seems all with him. Maybe if I had been more principled, I would have let the whole thing go down the drain, not taken it in the first place.
He stayed around, I guess.
He stayed around, but I didn't happen to be in Washington and talked to some people, and then he was invited to apply for a labor attaché, and he was had a very successful career as a labor attaché. And retired from them. Did very well. He would have been done very well here. Now, the difference between Ulrichson and me, he identified with the labor movement. He's one of them. I never pretended to be one of them, because I wasn't one of them. But I said my job was to It was to help the university see their needs and see what we could do, but we weren't, I wasn't part of the labor movement. And I didn't make no pretense. I got along very well at that. Bob Ozan was here doing graduate work, and we hired him as an assistant. And one day somebody said, "You better watch that Ozan, he'll have your job." And he did. He got my job within 2 years, and I got out.
You just reminded me.
No, I wanted, that's what I wanted desperately. That wasn't my career. My friends had told me, you see, if you get mixed up with that, you never can, you know, I wanted to be an economist. Yeah, conclusion to be an economist in those days. So that's, let me tell you one episode. It's typical of what happened. And this can be verified. It was one of the few things that I tell you about that can find the press. One of the first public meetings I had was in Ashland. We went up there to talk to the Federation of Labor, and the staff went along. And it was the first time I was going to speak. And they were, you know, they just dope, you know, we got him. You know, you can just imagine, you know, like any organization, they bring somebody in and doesn't know a damn thing. And that's where I was. And so they were shivering, because they were there. And here we were in this big room. And in those days, the first thing they did was pass out songs like, you know, these were Revolution, Solidarity Forever, and Union Girl Tonight or something, you know, and all kinds of, you know, stuff. Songs of kind of a... then sat down. Suddenly, Vic wrote me a note and said, "There is John. Wrote the Red Network. He was the editor that published the paper up there. I think it was Chapel. Has come in. He says you can't say anything. He says you know John Chapel. He was the one who wrote. I don't know if you know. He was permanently being. He was great pro-Russian. Went to Russia and came back." Very bitterly anti-communist, and wrote a book called The Red Network, which included a chapter calling Perlman a communist and so on.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Didn't know that.
No. Well, that was in the early 30s, or in the 30s, before my time. And that you better not say anything. And in fact, they would like to take me off the program because they didn't trust me in that atmosphere.
I mean, because you were from the university, and associated with Perlman.
Because of that we were going to get bad press from the School for Workers, no matter what we said, and they couldn't trust me to be say anything because I would might get us into difficulties. But so I got up and said that I was pleased to be in Ashland, Wisconsin. It reminded me of Maine because the northernmost town in Maine was called Ashland too, and here we were in the top of the state. Brought back memories of the farmhouse I grew up in. That one of the things I remembered in that farmhouse was a volume called Heartthrobs, edited by a man named Chapel. I said that there were many things in things of sentiment in that. Curfew shall not ring tonight, other such things. Very similar to the songs we've passed out here. These are not basic for action. These are part of a tradition, as those things were. I said, "I understand there's a Mr. Chapel here who may be related to the editor of that. I understand he plays the piano. Perhaps he'll play for us while we sing these songs." And by God, he did. We sang the labor songs. And the next day, for the only time in my life, the front page of the paper, exactly what I said, word for word, and no editorial comments. It's the only time I've ever had an honest report. That was my, you know, that was my big moment in my whole career. I never have achieved it since. You can look that up in the Ashland papers if you want to.
And did it just come to you?
Well, sure.
You must have thought very hard. What can I say?
Well, I had to while I was eating. You know, it's like you know, once in a while you have inspiration. That was the only time. That crew that was with me, they were a little astonished. It was always fun. I was testifying in Washington the other day before some committee, and all these, you know, Washington types were there, and they thought I didn't know what I was doing, but since I was the president-elect of the association, the chairman of this committee, and that, they had to let me testify. The same. Fun. the hard-working, intensive, bright people. Well, that's the school for workers.
I was just reading Faye Elwell's some remarks he made about the school
for workers. Oh, yes. Faye worked so hard to prevent the management from supporting. You see, Bob Fleming was brought here in 1948 to head up a Institute for Industrial Relations, which would bring management and labor together. And Faye worked very hard to make sure that the management side didn't support that.
But he didn't succeed.
Yes, he did. Bob left and went to Illinois.
But it was set up?
Yeah, well, I kept it going afterwards. But I changed the direction. From having labor management meetings and cooperation and conferences, we turned it to a research institute. Mm. Then later on it got turned to a degree granting. But no, he succeeded. Rush Mobley was his henchman in those days. Well, he was a music teacher who came here during the war to some training program and stayed on to run the management institute. Then he and Faye had a falling out. But he's now retired, but teaching part-time at Sheboygan Center. Interesting character. Well, I guess I'm reminiscing about these things, but that school for workers, it was a Finnish girl there who was so loyal to Ulrichsen, just a fine girl, and to the labor movement. And she would have done anything she could to sabotage me. And I knew she was doing it. And yet I was sympathized with her. See, my sympathies were really with Ulrichsen. Mm-hmm.
You said that, yeah.
Really. Well, these things happen. Well, what else is on your mind?
Well, I was going to ask you about when in the Department of Economics, mm-hmm. the chairman of this university was getting more and more crowded, John Sterling, mm-hmm. whether about the Commerce Building, whether you try to... I know Elwell wanted to have the Department of Economics made part of Commerce. Mm-hmm.
But they never got much support for it. The department certainly didn't want it, and the college didn't want it. See, Elwell's, part of his problem was that they were proud of letters and science for a long time, and he wanted a separate school, and the faculty voted against it, but the regents overruled the faculty. Elwell was a very able man, and I think that I don't know how, you know, the records get so confused, but the story I have, and I suspect there's a good deal of truth to it. Along about the First World War, there was a shortage of teaching staff, and he was just got his bachelor's, somebody who was so brilliant, but they asked him to teach. Then at the end of the war, he thought he had to go on and get a higher degree, and they said, you don't need that, to teach what you're teaching. We don't care. And so he didn't get a higher degree, which he could have gotten without any trouble. But it was always... that he always had that feeling that, you know, that they looked down on him because he didn't have it.
Yeah.
And he cultivated the more conservative business people. But then when he wanted to have his own school separate, the letters and science people voted against it, and the university faculty voted him down. So he had I read the manuscript.
As soon as you probably had
it. Yes, it's one of the few, I think I've only read two, that's one of them. And after reading that, I decided that these aren't worth much, because Faye was just repeating all the old, his old resentments against the university and what she had. But I don't think he should be underestimated. I had some run-ins with him when I was chairman of the economics department. One day, somebody came down and he had made some reference to those communists in the economics department. So I went right up and pounded the table in his face and said, now you either put up or shut up. Well, that he respected.
That
got to him.
That's the way he talked.
Yeah, that's the way he talked. Yeah. But too many good, able people respected him, not to discount him, in the business community and so on. He's, you know, he's still alive, but he's blind and very ill. I think the last time he was out, he came to our house to lunch, some affair I had for some business people of his age and people who had been helpful to the university in giving money. And he was always crotchety and complaining, but he had character. God, I like people with character.
Well, did you object to the interview because it presented him a quarrelsome side of him that you felt would under?
No, I thought what he was doing was just, I didn't learn anything new. He sort of repeated his complaints against the universe. That's about all. That's about all it was, wasn't it? Not much
more. He described a process, actually, it was quite interesting to me, view of looking into the building program, of how he got the Commerce Building, apparently didn't go through the building committee. Apparently there was some spare money lying around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happened very often.
No. He always worked outside the university, around it, through his influence with the Regents or something. That might have been, but I knew that anyway.
you know that, but that's the sort of thing.
Yeah, but I didn't. But no, I didn't. You know, it's all right. I wasn't objecting to him, but I didn't. You know, he didn't tell me much I didn't know. But I thought he was rather querulous in it.
He was.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, when you became chairman of economics, towards the end of the 50s.
You mean when that was it must have been 54.
Well, you were chairman 54 to 61, but what I'm interested in is there was a growing, apparently Harrington and Clodius and Sewell and others were concerned about money for the social sciences and the humanities and putting on a fair amount of pressure. And I know you were involved in the Gagliamata project at this time, and I would like to talk to you about that sometime.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you will.
The best source of information is Lisa Targo.
Well, yes, but I've interviewed her. You mean I should go again?
Done that. Oh, yeah, that's right. Of course, yes, we went over the thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, but sometime I'll be... But that, she's very accurate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, you see, at the time, I wasn't planning to go into the thing.
No.
Really get full information.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in is whether you, as chairman of the economics department, were concerned in this about this a feeling that there wasn't enough money going into the social sciences.
Well, there wasn't enough money going to economics, and I got money from Ford Foundation.
Yeah.
And then I got the money from the Wharf.
Did you get money from Wharf?
$100,000 to start to bring Guy Orchid and the whole business.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that, yes.
Oh, yes, I did that.
You did that.
Well, I got it through the graduate school, and they gave it to me because Connie didn't think that I could get him. He thought he could gamble $100,000.
He thought the money was safe because the rest wouldn't come.
Sure. Well, that's the honor, you know, that's what I believe, but of course, you can't. I can't prove that, you know, but I think I know the game.
Well, where did the... what made you think of doing it? I mean, was it you yourself, or were others saying, look, let's see if we can get some good people? Or
We had a... back up and think about it. We had a very difficult problem because the people who had made the name for the department all were retiring. Witte, Perlman, Groves getting on, and Lesko here, Glazier, and Commons had died, you see, and so we were going to slipping into becoming a third-rate department. And I was the most junior person with tenure in the department. And Morton had raised so much hell with Witte, and he forced Groves out in collusion with the Cap Times, which is one of the dirtiest pieces of business that ever happened.
I'm told I should ask you about Morton.
Well, don't ask me too much, but anyway, nobody could be chairman because he was he couldn't resist being a Machiavellian, always plotting and threatening and conniving, just the nature of the man, and he could be very extraordinarily charming and bright but troublemaker. And he had got to the point where they didn't, the department was just torn apart. And so they turned to me, not because they thought I had any particular qualities, but they could agree on me, because I didn't have any enemies particularly. I'm sure Walter supported me because he thought I'd do what he told me to, and you know, a lot of people thought that I was easy to influence. I was. But one of the byproducts, this department was badly torn, was that the senior people rallied round, and it was, if we could agree at a program, they'd support it. And I had people who had ideas. Jim Early had suggested some people to bring in. We got Pete Steiner from Berkeley, and Pete had ideas. And we'd talk it over, and a whole group of bright people come up with things. I wasn't, you know, there was no one person who was the architect of it, but I was the person who did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, because I had a little more, I suppose, they were scholars who were interested in what they were doing and saw themselves, and I looked at the department more as a whole and what could I do, and so I was able to get some money out of Ford. But
I thought it was Brittingham for Orchid.
Oh, that was Wharf for Orchid, mm-hmm. But maybe some Brittingham money too. Before that, I got a grant of $75,000 from Ford to use the discretionary fund.
I see.
Yes.
This was prior to the Gajimata grant.
Oh yes, this was nothing to do with Gajimata.
No, I know, but I mean,
yeah, yes,
except
yes,
they're both from Ford.
Yes, I think it was. I'm not sure, you'd have to look up the dates, but they're completely separate from different divisions. One of the
yeah,
seven,
I see that. But,
yeah, they had nothing to do with each other.
Oh, I see. One would have been from perhaps the
economic
the
section,
development program,
and one was the international section,
and
completely
one was
different.
The fellowship. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I see.
Yeah.
So it wasn't Mike Harris had nothing to do with that.
No,
obviously.
Nothing at all
yeah.
to do with that. No. So they were quite separate things, and
were they giving money to other
yes,
all over the country?
No,
to
several schools, mm-hmm. and apply for it, and make a
oh,
case.
I seem to remember that. I was working for 45 days at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
In those days, they had more confidence in people. They were less eager to direct than they are now. Now
so
they
said,
want
here's money and do what you want.
Well, yeah. Well, then if you had some ideas. And that money was the most useful money because I spent it over and over again. I'd use it to pledge, you know, somebody were applying for a grant, they wanted to plan, I'd pledge them the money, and then I'd take it back and they got the grant. You know. Well, I spent that over and over again.
Yeah.
I was a fairly good manager of that, of small sums.
Mm-hmm.
It's the big ones that get me down. You know, you got $700 million or something like that, that's possible. But anyway, that's... And so we got the, but it was outside of Walter Morton, the department really pulled together very well. People had been arguing and fighting with him, quarreling with each other. And one of the things that happens, I think, very often, as academics get older, they tend to be competitive and are more interested in their students and their disciples than they are in each other. They pull apart, if you think of the department.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the history
sure.
is, but I suspect it's
yeah.
so. And but they would, the one thing they would agree, they just delivered from all kinds. So I had the greatest support. And we finally had to finish Morton off, and that was, when that was done, we were on our way.
Was that the trip up to Fred at the whole economics department?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was the day.
Mm.
And the person who turned the tide was Blackie Ellsworth.
Hmm.
Paul Ellsworth, who'd been a great supporter of Morton's and a theorist and so on.
Well, why did he turn the tide?
Because he said, it's time for us to be honest and face up to what this man's doing to us.
Was it a sort of paranoid? I gather Howard Becker did the same thing in sociology.
Walter was paranoid, yes, he was.
Mm.
Well, one episode. us all, you know, that there's so many things, and memory is so selective. But the shortly after I became chairman, Mr. Perlman, who was my major professor, and even when I was an assistant professor, I acted as his assistant because he needed somebody, and I enjoyed tremendous mind. It's, you know, being around a very great intellect, that was a great joy. He said to me, he said, you know, I can't stand it. I've got to vote with Walter on everything. I said, why is that? He said, well, he comes over to my house every night, and he beats on me until I agree to tell you what to do. I said, I can protect you. He said, how are you going to do that? I said, we're going to have an understanding. From now on departmental matters, I've never paid the least attention to anything you say, and then once Walter discovers that, he'll not bother you anymore. It hurt the old man, but he had to come into him, you see. If he didn't, couldn't stand up, you know, it's like, you know, it was tough. But those were the kind of things that happened. Harold Groves was prince in all this. He always was. He was great. There's a very great man.
Say he was, what was the term? He was thrown out or gotten rid of?
Yes, but that was Walter had an alliance. Right at the end of the war, Harold was chairman of the department, and he got some money from the CED, Committee for Economic Development, to do a tax study. So Walter got the Cap Times and front page stories to attack him for taking money from the interest and trying to sell out to the business interest and all this. I mean, this is something you look at the papers, you know, and check on, because, you know, it was bad that Harold felt he had to resign. For a while, the dean was chairman of the department. Now, one of the sidelights of this, though, was that, as near as I could tell, no matter how these men quarreled amongst themselves, they never let it affect the graduate students. One man never took it out on anybody else's student, as near as I ever knew. I never knew of a case. They were very honorable, all of them, in spite of their differences, in that respect.
That's an interesting point.
I think it's an important point. Now, it may be something I don't know about, but to my knowledge, it never happened. The students didn't suffer. Sometimes they knew what some things were going on, and they might have thought something was going to happen and felt threatened, but to my knowledge, it never happened.
And I gather Morton, although I gather he was not, I mean, that he was perhaps not a popular teacher, but that he was, people did take his classes and were interested.
Oh, yes. Well, he was chairman of the theory committee. Nobody dared not take his classes.
Oh.
And he would give them a very hard time in class, but when he came to grading, he never took any. The students never knew whether he read the papers or not, but they took his course because they were afraid he was, you know.
I see. Ted Morton was saying that he heard them out.
But he actually, for a semester, it was very entertaining because he was a very skillful critic. He used to refer to the Keynesian economics as plumbing economics.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, that's sort of kind of...
Have all had your work cut out for you, sort of setting things right.
Well, it was an impossible job, you know. That's what I'd say. The hardest job I ever had. Mm-hmm. And if it hadn't been for Walter Morton, I wouldn't be sitting here.
I get it. I'm not saying that, but I mean, I've heard that you held the economics department together.
Yes. Well, not only did we hold it together, but with some help, built it.
You built it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you say you solved it. It wasn't that you got rid of him, but that he calmed down, or...
Well, we ostracized him, really.
Uh-huh.
Just said, we aren't going to pay any attention to him anymore. I agree. And he's just as friendly now, cheerful when I see him. He's just active. He's still making money. He's a consultant for private utilities. He's marvelous on adverse cross-examination because he ridicules the opposition. He's very clever with his time. Extraordinarily clever man.
You know, it would be tempting to ask you how many people there are at any one time. I know that the botany department had, whether over an individual, but there were similar problems. Mm-hmm. Had the dean's chairman. And the social department, economics. This must go on from one department to another.
Well, there's always some department that's at the lower end of the range.
But I mean, with a person who is, for some reason, really creating havoc.
Yes.
There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Democracy is a very fragile thing. See, the university governance really depends on a sense of live and let live, allow the other person to do something. But if you spend your time at it, you can raise a lot of havoc. You look at the faculty senate, the two or three people there, whom I won't name here, but who could keep most of the turmoil there.
Yeah.
And they don't add much to the intellectual life of the place besides.
Mm-hmm.
My narrow view. I'm talking about their own fields.
Yes. You were talking about the Ford money.
Yes.
And getting Guy Orchid here.
Mm-hmm. Well, we decided, Peter Steiner, I think, was the one who had this idea, that we ought to get somebody in econometrics, some first-class person, because we didn't have much strength. And we... somehow somebody got the notion that Guy Orchid might be restless at Harvard. So I went to Harvard and saw Sumner Slichter. Now Sumner Slichter, his father had been the dean here. Sumner always had great affection for this place. And I was in labor relations, so I went and visited with him. And I told him about our problems, and he said, well, we ought to get somebody, and he named it. He said somebody like Dorfman or Orchid or somebody like that, but he said, of course, you can't get one of those because they're at Harvard, and, you know, nobody's going to leave Harvard and go to Wisconsin. He said, you know, I might, but if I were younger, but these people aren't. And I said, that's very interesting, but maybe I'd visit with them and talk and get their advice, because it was so I visited around and talked to Orchid and talked to him about his ambitions. He was an associate professor that they hadn't promoted quite fast enough. You see, I was so he wasn't as happy as he, and he had this vision of a model of the American economy. Well, I'm not smart enough to know too much about modeling, but I had a feeling that, as we talked about it, that the pieces he needed to put that together were so important in economics that whether it all came together whole or the bridge didn't quite get there, we still would have it. So I was quite enthusiastic and came back and talked to our people. I asked, in those days, $100,000 was a lot of money from the graduate school. So I asked the graduate school for $100,000. And the story I have, and this is only secondhand, because I wasn't there, that they met with the regents in Milwaukee and said, well, you know, we've been accused of not giving money to the social sciences, and they're pushing, Ed Young's pushing, and he thinks he's going to do all this now. Obviously, he's going to get that man, and so, you know, we offered the money, and they did. And I got the man. And then Guy was a tremendous person, and recruited some people, went to Ford and got a lot of money, too, and then we went on from there. And the NSF, the second half of that building was built with grant money that we got.
Social science
research thing. So that whole story was fun. But there was one episode in it that really shows that was kind of fun. In 1955-56, I was a Ford Fellow. I took a leave and went to Brussels, and because I was interested in some international things. And during that year, they used my salary to bring Bob Lampman as a visitor from Washington. And of course, Bob was, everybody knew, was tremendous. And we'd been fellow graduate students, and he was certainly one, if not the outstanding, probably was the outstanding one of our group. And so we tried to get him to stay, but he went back. But then, whatever year it was that Orchid came, was the Economic Association meetings were in Philadelphia. I didn't go that year for some reason. Bob called me on the phone, woke me up in the middle of the night and said, Ed, I've heard what you're doing there, and I guess I'm ready. I've talked to Guy Orkin, I'm ready to come back. So I offered him a tenured position on the phone.
Without any of the money or anything.
No money, no approval of the department.
Yeah.
Should have been fired for that. Mm-hmm. But I was on pretty sure ground because Bob was not. Things don't go by orderly planning, very orderly. You have to know where you want to come out at. But so much of it is chance and timing, enthusiasm of people, good, you know.
So
what did
you do then?
How did
you get the money?
For Lamont?
Yeah.
I can't even remember. Probably hired fewer teaching assistants, did something. Those were the years where our budgets were growing, you know. Money wasn't, money for one salary. Maybe we had a position for 1 year, yeah. So I could plan ahead, you know, something like that. I was that sort of thing I could do quite skilled. I always had my Ford money I could throw in the line if I had to.
Yeah.
So that was an exciting time.
Yes, it must have been. And did you, were you consciously working, or did you talk with Sewell and Harrington? Did you all share a feeling that you got to keep pushing? Or
yes indeed. And Bill was a leader in pushing. He was one of the chair of the committee in pushing for social science support. And when Harrington was assistant vice president at some stage, and he was helpful. He was working with Mr. Baldwin. Mr. Baldwin was always very helpful too.
He was.
I always thought so. I used to go see Mr. Fred about something and stay for an hour with him. And at the end, I'd be so frustrated with him, with horse raising and in Virginia and all the things he talked about except the subject. So I'd finally go down the hall and I'd say, Mr. Baldwin, I don't care anymore. Just put me out of my misery. Tell me yes or no.
And he did.
He did, because he was the man who knew. Yeah. He was the hatchet man is the wrong word for Mr. Baldwin, but he was the one who kept the steady things steady and organized together. Never got appropriate credit, although, you know, later on, the university gave him an honorary degree for his work in Indonesia, which was very outstanding.
Small part of it,
yes.
Of what he did.
That was after he retired.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But he's been under the things he did in those years, I'm very honest. But you see, there was some resentment around because the biologists had controlled the whole place. Fred and Baldwin were bacteriologists, and Connie was a biochemist, and they kept their hands on everything. That sort of appeared.
I've heard a great deal about that.
Yes. And I was one of the young Turks who didn't think this was appropriate.
Oh, yeah, I wondered. I was going to ask you and didn't know whether you would say that or not.
Why, sure. Why not say it? It's
right.
True.
Who knows how diplomatic you might think you should be. But
oh, I'm not. I'm too old to be diplomatic. I mean, these things are nothing very serious about that. We had the same thing last time we picked a chancellor at Madison. The physical scientists organized till hell wouldn't have it to make sure they got one of their own. They got a good one, but they were not going to let anything happen to avoid, prevent it. I mean, they thought it was their turn. Groups feel that way, you know. I don't know why, but they do.
Evidently, in choosing the dean after Alfie became president, John Willard, there was a very strong push to get somebody who would at least pay a bit of attention to such a sign.
Yes.
Were you in on this? Do you remember? Alan White was head of the committee.
No, I wasn't very active in that. I was active in the associate deanship business.
What do you mean?
Well, see, they were looking for associate dean. I was one of the people that they interviewed, pretending that it was for some other reason. That's when Clodius was picked.
Oh, I see.
Because I think Mr. Fred felt an egg man would be safer.
Oh. even though Ag had all the offices up to then.
Yeah. But of course, it could have been on merit too. You know, it's just possible. Sometimes things are on merit. And Clodius, in some ways, I was chairman. You know, I wasn't about to give up the chairmanship to do it anyway, so it was not a question of my being disappointed. But I was amused by the operation.
Mm-hmm. You mean not telling you what you were being taught?
Yes.
Did you know at the time?
Yes.
Well.
Yes, I knew.
Well, could you talk a bit about the planning for the building, the social sciences building, because that was a very bitter affair.
Yes. Now, nothing bores me as much as the building program, actually. So I did what I had to do, but I paid as little attention to it. But now let me see if I can reconstruct it. But Kurt Wendt is the best source of information because he's always
the
most.
I'm interested in what you felt about it. I know some of the facts about it.
Okay, well, let me tell you what I felt about it.
All right.
There was a plan where there would be a building which economics and law would share.
Economics and law, not sociology and law.
Not sociology and law. And the dean of the law school at the time, this is what I believe, decided to get rid of. No, wait a minute. No, the priority list was the social science building. That's it. The dean of the law school, without consulting us, or at least I didn't know anything about it, cooked up a deal with sociology that the building priority would go to law and sociology and economics would be shut out. And they got the thing going along beautifully, and then suddenly out of all the law and bar, they discovered you couldn't have a combined sociology and law school, and they were just too bad, but sociology had to be pushed out.
You mean after sociology and help them get the priority?
Yes. And now remember, this is my version.
Yes.
And don't,
yes.
It's very right. Shaky, it's what I believe, but yes. It's very, I haven't spent, you know, I don't go spend a lot of time digging up what happened because plenty happening now. But anyway, that's what I, and so I then moved in and said, look, you not only did you steal our priority and give it to the law school, but now you've knocked the associate out and we're entitled to a building.
Well, you're talking to Kurt Wendt.
Talking to the administration.
Oh.
Yeah, and anybody I could get a hold of. And they were a little contrite, but because we really, the sociologists got double-crossed. Now, we would have gotten some space, but out of because sociology left the building, but not that much. So that was the basis. And then came the big argument about where to put it. And we were told we could have it over here or nowhere. And then came the whole row about Bascom Woods and all the virgin trees that where we were cutting down. Nobody bothered to walk out there and see the concrete that had been dumped in there over the years where the old road used to be. You know, that wasn't virgin woods at all. But we had a tremendous, that was the first big, I remember meeting one dowager woman from town, and she said, why are you insisting on building your building on Picnic Point? And I said, how did you know we were putting a building on Picnic Point? She said, I read the Capital Times every day. But anyway, it was quite a row. But it got resolved, and of course, the undying line was drawn beyond which no building will ever go, and it's all to the good. But and then I was chairman of the building committee.
Oh, you were. This was as chairman of the department.
Yes.
This was before you were dean. Yeah.
Yes. And then, so we had endless meetings. And of course, the whole building committee scheme is a crazy one. That all the people on the committee have never participated in the building before and never will again. And they deal with the state, but not directly and through intermediaries. And so it's amazing that the buildings aren't worse than they are, although I.
You mean they can't really know what they could have or.
No, they don't. They don't know enough. They either try to reproduce some building they've seen somewhere or they had last time or
yeah,
something.
I should think that would be especially
with people. Oh, look, this place is a monument to mistakes.
Hmm.
First place, the architects aren't to be trusted because they're not interested in making something better. They're interested in making a reputation by designing something different.
Yeah.
And then the pressure comes on them to get more space than they've got money for, so they cheat on the insulation. They put in, you know, they have sealed windows and all the things we've got all. You know, Bascom is such a lovely building and functional compared with anything they've built since. I feel very bitter about this, but I'm not really enamored of our system of building.
Well, if you aren't, why haven't you done something about it?
We aren't going to build anymore, so why get excited about something that's in the past? The building's behind us. And besides that, you know, you can't. I was always more interested in programs than in the buildings. And as chancellor, I had Kurt Wendt to steer the building things for me, and he did a superb job.
But so you don't think it was the campus planning committee that was behind this, but what the state architects were?
You mean the mistakes?
Yeah.
Well, it's the way the state picks architects and the kind of building committees we had. Faculty, and the combination of, see, the architect is picked not by any competition, but
yeah.
It takes turns passing it around. And we had no choice over the architects usually.
Yes.
And if we did, we didn't know enough to pick them,
yeah.
You see. So we never, no lesson, look at Ellen White, one more recent one, looks like a parking ramp.
Mm-hmm.
Look here, they stuck four floors on top of a building without putting any extra elevators in. That was the building commission did that at the last minute.
Ben. Jairus Leonard, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not one of my favorite, one of the things that really interests me very much, the buildings.
Did you say that? And that's what Mark Ingram said too, but I don't know if you read my letter. Did you read my letter to you, in which I quoted from David Feldman about the fact that whoever makes the decisions about buildings has a big say in how the campus. And maybe I should have asked you, do you agree with that?
No,
maybe you don't.
Not entirely. No, not that much. It has some influence. One of the interesting things I've always noticed is how much energy the Ag School always put into building programs.
Mm-hmm.
Always asking for a great deal. Now, recently I just had a whole spate of letters from every Ag group in the state supporting. They wind up the machinery and the apparatus and all that. But that wasn't, you know. I sometimes ask my friends how much their productivity went in up when they moved from a little hole in the wall over to this building. Oh, they don't. They won't say that, but obviously there's not much they can say because
I've heard a good deal of complaint about the difference between being at Bass, especially being at
Bass High. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think it makes that much difference, you see.
Yeah.
But it is a constant problem. Now, for the scientists, the laboratory scientists, it does.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, it's very stupid, because in the chemistry building, there's lots of waste space because the chemists who use labs insist on having the same number of square feet as those, the ones who didn't use labs, same number of square feet as those who did. For their, they have each had two offices, one the private lab, just a waste.
This must be Hugh Richards said that what you ought to do is compare what people in chemistry had here and what they had in other campuses instead of how what they had compared to what physics had or what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, well, here we tried to get them to be in. McArdle was done beautifully from a point of view of money and efficiency. I'm not talking about the outside of it, that's a matter of taste, but Hugh Rush worked at that in a scientific way. Tried to get the chemists to look at it, they said they couldn't, they weren't interested in looking at that. That was on 8-foot modules, they had to have 10. Why did they have to have 10? Well, because one man had a machine that was 10 feet long or some damn foolishness. The day they opened the first chemistry building, new, I was dean, and they came in and said, well, before they opened it, they had to have $100,000 to remodel it. I said, my God, you're not in it yet. What do you need? That was like saying $400,000 now or something. Well, the chairman of the building committee made a lot of mistakes. You know, he's not very bright or something like that. And I said, well, why is he chairman of the building committee? He said, well, we didn't have anything else for him to do. Now, they would deny it now, but this man would do that. It turned out, I discovered later, some very difficult psychiatric problems. So they made him chairman of the building committee. I don't know. But so the whole bunch of experiences. They built that math building, you know, with windows that sealed and the sun baking in there, cooking them. So then they have to go out and spend hundreds of thousands putting the air conditioning in. It's that kind of stuff. And, you know, we didn't have a very good system. Now, the state gave us lots of buildings, and it's that we didn't know enough.
But that must be the Department of Planning and Construction. I mean, surely somebody around should be knowledgeable enough.
Well, our planning and construction people are architects. They never learned anything either. That's my view about. I mean, they were living by the standards of architects, which is to get a new idea, try a new concept. You see, rather than here's something that works. Now they aren't all like that. I'm exaggerating, of course, but it's. But I think it's a fascinating subject, but it's one on which I became very unhappy very early with it. Not because of any personal experiences. Oh, only one. When I was on the building committee years ago, I tried to get some shelters for bus shelters. I talked about bus shelters. And Edsel would always say, well, you couldn't do that. Well, why not? Well, it might be used for immoral purposes. I said, no, put you out of your mind. Well, whatever come in, he was determined it wouldn't be, because it didn't fit into his concept. And he frustrated me. And I when I was chancellor, I passed the word, unless we got some bus shelters, we're going to get somebody's going to get fired. I had no intention of firing anybody. I never fired anybody in my life. But I finally got some bus shelters.
Bless you for that.
But they're not good enough. That isn't what I wanted. See, I wanted a closed, heated place where people could go and sit and read for half an hour and not mind waiting for the bus and be warm. And I'm going to get it.
No, I wish you would.
But that was one of the kind of things, you know, I wasn't asking for much.
No. That's
but you know, always talking about the students now, environmentalists, how they're opposed to cars and so on, the representatives. When we had a proposal about 15 years ago that to limit the cars and the parking in order to enhance the public transportation, it was the student leaders who joined with the parking, the car proponents, and saying, by God, not only should there be parking for the faculty, but we got to have parking too.
I was thinking of the cars on campus, do you remember? But that was 1953 or so, 63.
Yeah.
When they were going to ban cars from Bascom Hill,
yeah.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, we went through that. But see, we tried it, you know, we had Bascom closed for a while, but it doesn't work because you've got to have the buses in wintertime. See, we found that the cost of running the buses around the hill was tremendous.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, you see, the buses get paid by the hour. And was a tremendous difference in the cost of the.
I had no. You see, I heard was that somebody had, the Secretary of the Regents had gone to the old rules and discovered that you had to have access to all buildings.
Well, to this drive out here.
Yeah.
But the reason we didn't fight that really, that was under the condition of that was the condition in which we accepted that drive. That was the old Pleasure Drive Association of Madison. Gave us the drive, Willows Drive, and the whole thing, but actually the statistics of the cost would have made it very difficult. See, if we running the buses are not going over Bascom, when that period we lost an awful lot of money on those buses.
That's fascinating.
So that there were both reasons were involved, but the economic one. See, the difficulty with this place is, in part, the bicyclists are not as vehement as they were, but they want everything turned into a bicycle path. That works until Thanksgiving, but from Thanksgiving to April, you have to have cars and buses. And so, and for instance, now with the handicap rules, you couldn't close the drive. People, the most vocal group we've got, probably for the numbers, is the handicap, and they have to park up next to Bascom, and rightly so. So, we could get special legislation, which would. Limited to buses, and I don't think that I think the legal side could be solved, but the financial side would be very difficult. And but the thing, it seems to have quieted down for the time being. It'll get stirred up again one day.
You mean the cars and parking distance?
The cars and versus no cars and so on. Mm-hmm. But the important thing is having the buses, I think. But
who was responsible for that?
Buses. System, I would guess somewhere behind that is Kurt Wendt's hand. Most of the good things around here that happened on campus planning and buildings and things with Kurt Wendt, sooner or later. One thing he's failed to do succeed in is get the University Avenue moved south.
I was going to ask you about that. Most interesting issue.
But, well, I just know of his, I would love to have it happen, but we, the city would never agree to it. We saved the space down there to do it, but John Bunch and then the people downtown, they weren't, and that, whether it's practical or not, I don't know, but anyway, it would have been a nice thing to have done.
But, so you think Kurt, well, I could talk to him, I had heard that he felt that there wasn't any possibility and didn't even fight for it.
For what?
For having a, well, I guess, no, this is the, having university a depressed.
I don't know that he fought for that because of the water level, lake water level, you know, you've got to worry about that. Were you going to?
I hadn't.
You hadn't thought of that. Well, I mean, you look out here, and there's a, that level, is that. How far down can you go before you strike water? I don't know. Not very far.
What a simple reason for not having it. Well, I thought it was just too much money. I've talked to several people about it, and they all said it cost too much.
Well, I don't know. Ask Kurt about it. But that was. Why would that be in my mind is the reason. I mean, well, if it's not, Kurt wanted to do something much better than that, and that was to have it go down along Regent Street where we saved the land for years to put it down there, so you can have it rooted around, go down Reese Terrace to Road.
Clodius thinks that's his idea, or did he told?
Well, the first document, the first person who, thing that, the document that I've seen about changing pattern here, was Kurt Wendt's undergraduate thesis. That was prior to Clodius. Yes. Well, a lot of people joined up with different versions of it, you know. And, you know, ideas always have a number of authors.
You should go and look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd talk to him about it. Because my experience with Kurt is he's very, very accurate.
Social sciences building.
Yes.
I do wonder about whether the back of it was planned at the same time as the front, because it seems to be sort of obtrusive compared to the classroom part, the research building.
Yeah, I don't recall that it was.
Well, I know it wasn't built at the same time.
No, but I don't think, I can't recall the planning. Remember, right in the middle of this building before it really got, I don't know how far along it was. I can't even remember when. I went off to Pakistan.
They started building in 1960.
Yes. You see, and before it was finished, I was off to Pakistan. And when I came back, I was dean, 61. So, but I don't remember. I don't believe it was planned at the time. Certainly, I didn't know.
Anyway, it's not an issue.
No.
Made it up myself.
The issue was putting a building there at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we were told it's there or nowhere.
Well, when you were in Sterling, mm-hmm. how did you feel about having all the money given for the wing for the Army Math Research Center? Because I gather that everybody was very crowded in Sterling.
Never occurred to have any feeling at all except that the money was given by WARF for that purpose, and we wanted to get the university wanted the Math Research Center. I didn't care very much either way. It never was an issue to my knowledge. I couldn't even tell you now when that was built.
It was
1956 or 6. Yes. Rudolph Langer was a man the first director and was pushing. And he was the one who got the Math Research Center. It was quite a coup to get it, because a lot of people were competing for it.
I guess
so.
In that building at the math department.
Yes, it did.
And it also meant a lot of. What is the money called when?
The overhead?
Yes, but there's another term, more of a term.
Indirect. Cost?
Direct reimbursement.
Yes, but we don't make any money off that.
You did then?
Maybe for a short time, but by and large, taking university-wide we don't. That may have been for a short time, but the real asset was to have money to hire these first-class mathematicians who would come, and then we could attract them to the math department. That was the real thing. And of some fellowship, so it really enhanced the quality of the mathematics around here, and it also led to help not only math, but computing and statistics very greatly. I think George Box came in, didn't he come in the Math Research Center first? So, George Box, who became the first chairman of the statistics department. Son-in-law, by the way, of Mr. Fisher, Fisher's Law, you know, the great statistician, English statistician.
I do. Were you on the research committee? I'm trying to go into things on your pre-deanship.
No.
Never. Surprising. So I won't ask you anything about it. I would be interested in your version of the first LVM's getting to be president, and then Harrington. I know Harrington was the candidate of some people.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, the Regents, when Mr. Fred announced his retirement, set up a advisory committee to the Regents on selection, and it was made up of two parts, the administrative side and the faculty side. The administrative side would have deans on it, the dean's side, and then there was the faculty side. Connie Elvin was chairman of the dean's group, and I was, as chairman of the university committee, chairman of the faculty side. So we had two committees, but we met jointly. And we met with the Regents, and I remember that first meeting with the Regents, which Matt Werner, who had been around for a long time, said, well, you know, this time we should level with the faculty. That made an impression on me that sometime they might not have. And I haven't ever checked into what happened when Mr. Fred was made president. But anyway, that was the beginning. We had lots of names. And at almost every meeting, Connie would give us a lecture on all it takes. Is somebody willing to make up his mind, make a decision, that's all it takes to be a president. After about the third meeting when he made these remarks, I got him aside and said, Connie, you're so obviously a candidate, why don't you get off the committee? Oh. Because Connie, a wonderful man. Did you ever know him? He was a very great scientist. His contribution in with rickets and things, very great. But he had been graduate dean. Now, the graduate dean is very decisive, especially in those days. What he decides is who gets the money, and he hands it out to them, and they take it. And that's decisiveness. And the other place he'd been decisive, he had these graduate students, and they had to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning and lined up and told them what to do, and they did it. So, I'm exaggerating, but you know, there's some of this to it, as I observed it. Well, anyway, it emerged there were really two serious candidates, Harrington and Elvin. And I made very careful that we didn't try to, by this time I was really the chairman of the group, the faculty advisory group. We met with Regents two or three times, and I made sure we didn't do any rating. But they wanted several candidates, so we just added two more people. I've even forgotten who they were. But when we met, I remember what Charlie Gillette was one of the Regents. He said, "You insult us by bringing in those other names." He didn't think much of the people we brought in, and I can't remember at the moment who they were. But I didn't. We weren't serious about them either. By a very narrow vote, they selected Elvin.
Yes, I gathered it was narrow. Mm-hmm. So, and it was they who voted.
Oh, the decision was made, yes. The decision was made not by the committee. Mm-hmm. The committee would have been split too. Mm-hmm. Because against the scientific community and against the social science.
So I should, that would be something to interview with some of those regents about. Well, it's just interesting
on, you
that
know,
since there have been so many scientists all along, you would have thought they would have been ready for, to have a...
Well, remember the distinction of this university in large part came from that egg school, from the biologists. They're basic scientists, they're not agriculturalists. You know, that's the Nobel Prize, that's where they come from. Look at the biochemistry. And so there was, there's that side to it. Most businessmen, a little suspicious of social scientists, who they call themselves anyway, and they felt solid. And Connie was a very distinguished scientist and also had been a graduate dean and chairman of a most prestigious department in the university, probably at the time. Certainly one of the two or three, if not the most. Himself, a native of Wisconsin, you know,
yes,
Norwegian,
that
had a lot of things.
Yeah.
No one of which would be determining, but so one could argue whichever way. Now, my own simple. I suppose if I'd been voting secretly, I would have voted probably for Harrington. I would have voted for Harrington, I think. Knew him better, more of my vision of where the university ought to be going. But anyway, at the same time they appointed him president, they told him to make Harrington vice president, which is kind of interesting, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then I went off to, shortly thereafter, I went to Pakistan and then came back as dean. And Connie was one of the best people you could ever think to work for. He left me alone, he was supportive, and he was terribly troubled. He had the medical school row in his hands about killing me. He had very good friends on both sides in a very bad dispute, and there was no way to be decisive. It just wasn't any way.
He used to thinking of himself as decisive.
You know, that there's the right answer and the wrong answer, if you just thought it through.
Yeah.
Well, there's many of these things, there's no right and no wrong answers. You don't know what to do, and this was weighed on him very, very heavily. Probably in, you know, you can believe it may have contributed to his death, I don't know. But anyway, let's see, when did he die? In the summer of 62?
I thought it was 61, but maybe it was 62.
Mm, must have been 62.
Yes, 62. Yes, Harrington became president in 62, so obviously that's
when. Yes. I was in Maine in the summer of 62. Family, and I got a call from Bill Young saying that Connie had died. Bill was the chief budget officer and lobbyist and so on. By the way, Bill's version of this might be interesting. Bill doesn't. I think Bill is also one of the people, the way if he tells you anything, it'll be accurate. How much he tells,
yes,
is another issue.
It's a big effect.
Have you, do you know him?
I've been told that there wouldn't be any point really in talking to him because he wouldn't be likely to.
I'd find that out for myself.
Oh, all right.
Mm-hmm. But you may be right, but I'd find it out for myself. But because if he talked to you, it would be accurate. And he called me, and so I came back. Meantime, Harrington had gone out to Hawaii to be interviewed for the presidency, and had informally probably accepted it. I'm not quite sure where stages were, but he's going to Hawaii. We had a meeting in Mr. Baldwin's office. I remember Jake Friedrichs, was president of the Board of Regents. Charlie Gillette was there, two or three others. I was there. And the decision was, do we start all over again with a search and screen, or do we go to Harrington? That was the issue. And I remember one of the regents turned to me and said, Ed, I think it was Charlie Gillette, but I'm not sure, What does the faculty think? I said, don't you care what the deans think? I was a dean by this time. He says, no, you tell us what the faculty thinks. I remember that spy play. Well, anyway, they decided to, so somebody phoned Harrington. That's how it happened. That, at least that's what I believe happened. Charlie Gillette might tell you a more complicated story. Do you know Charlie Gillette?
No.
I don't. There's a man who was on the board for about 28 years, wasn't he? Something like that. Youngest member, long time. Very bright. And
one of the things I was going to ask you was which of the regents would be the ones to talk to for who would be most helpful, and what do you think were the best ones for the university? DeBartolini was there at that time.
Yeah. Well, the two activists involved in everything were DeBartolini and Gillette. They were younger. You see, many of the others are gone. Who else was there?
In that year, Connick, Warner, Jensen, Gillette, Steiger, Bassett, DeBartolini, Friedrich, and Watson.
Watson's gone. Friedrich died the other day. I went to Matt Werner's funeral in the fall. Jensen's living in New Hampshire. Connick is still down around Racine, but I would say that if I were the people who were deeply involved and in on everything were Gillette and DeBartolini.
Yes.
And of course Harrington knows the deal. I spent some time with him in Washington the other day. We see each other on the airplanes in Washington.
But I want to ask you, Nelson was governor at the time.
Yeah.
And I should imagine, I know he was concerned about the university.
Yeah.
And one thing, for instance, he'd said there was no long-range campus planning, and why not? Do you know whether he would have had anything to say about the presidency?
I doubt if he got very much involved in it. I don't know that he did, but I don't. You know, you never know. See, there's some. If you know something happened, you know it. But if you don't know, it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No, that's true. But you're more likely to know if it did happen than I am. Than many other people. That's
yes.
You don't know.
And I don't. And I doubt it. Mm-hmm. I doubt it. One thing about the regents, by and large, no matter which party picks them, they may at first, but after a little while they don't run to the governor. Mm. By and large. It's really interesting. It's an interesting thing to watch. You watch them the first year or so, and they go down quite a lot. And then they go less and less. But Gaylord, you know, knowing him, he might have made some drop some word, but I don't think he would have tried to use the governor's office to influence it, but he could have. But you were dealing with people that they wouldn't pay much attention to it.
Yeah. Yes, like that would be that too. Mm-hmm. Does anything else occur to you around that time?
No.
You knew Harrington well, and you knew, did you know Kurt Wendt by then?
Well, I knew him.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd seen him. See, I didn't really know him much before I became dean, and we were fellow deans.
I see. That's how I got to know. Before that, you hadn't had. I wonder when you started being associated.
No, when I started serving on the university, I don't think I was ever on the campus planning committee as a faculty member. Although
you wouldn't have been, because they only started having them in 59.
Well, see, I could have been on then as the university committee representative.
Yes.
But I don't think I was. But anyway, that's where I got to know Kurt Wentz on there. And over the years to increasingly admire him. At first, I thought he was concerned about the engineering college, but it really turned out he was not. He's most, of all the administrators around Dean at that level, he's the most university-wide man I knew. The other deans were looking out, and I think if you could criticize him, it was because he wasn't selfish enough for his college, although he did all right by it in a kind of quiet way.
There are differences of opinion.
I know, but I've seen a lot of it. You know, yes. I'm one of the people who's been around as long as almost as anybody seen with you. And it's remarkable what a good group of deans we've had around here. Just marvelous group. You know, Glenn Pound's a very good dean. He and I differ a good deal, you know. And he's once, twice when I was chancellor, he threatened to resign unless I changed my ways, but I didn't pay attention to that. But we've been very good dean. So we're going to, you know, it's his last year coming up.
I
could, you better, because he's going to move to the West Coast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's going to retire in San Diego. Uh-huh. He has very bad hay fever and can't go back to Arkansas or stay here. Yeah. And so he bought a condominium out there.
But where does he go?
Well, I think he has one more year.
Oh,
it's this year. Yeah. So you've got to get him this year.
Yeah.
So, well then, you were made dean. Do you want to talk about how you, I know that there were several choices.
I don't know. See, I wasn't in the country. I was in, this whole dean thing went on. I didn't know I left the country as chairman of the economics department and went off to Pakistan and worked with Harvard Advisory Group. And when I was gone, I was selected as dean, and how it happened, I don't know, and I never inquired. It seemed to me most unlikely and silly, but things do happen.
Were you pleased?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, it's the colleagues nominate you and get picked. Mm-hmm. See, after all, being Dean of Letters and Science was a very prestigious thing. That was a, you know, the deans of that place were something. I was the turning point. You know, before that, they'd all been there for 20 years or more.
Yes,
that's good
to say.
Yes. No, I was pleased.
Well, if you have time, what state in regard to, what state did you find LMS and what did you, I know it was terribly crowded, people were desperate for space at that time. I've looked through the files, there were
yes.
Mm-hmm. Chairman. And so, since I'm thinking about building meetings
yes.
towards you, what did you think you had to do about it?
Well, I had to get the money to get buildings where we could, but remember the departments were also proponents of buildings, and so we had a lot. So it was a question of getting it where we could, and they were coming along, and I pushed for them, but I didn't, you know, I never was life or death in the building, but the circumstances, the evidence was so clear, and with Kurt involved, he was so, tried to be, to always get back, now this is what people have, and this is what they need, and so on, you know, once people, there were enough people around who were. I shouldn't get much of any credit for buildings. There were people pushing. Every group was pushing. Somebody in every group was pushing for buildings. I remember one time, Farrington Daniels took us down to the old chemistry building. It was an old piece of it in the back, built during World War I on wooden beams, and he explained to us if an atom bomb went off in Madison how the walls would pull apart and the whole thing would come down. I'll never forget that as long as I live. And that impressed everybody and they shook their heads and we had to have a new chemistry building. With things like that and all makes you so you don't every time I was trying to take it seriously something like that would happen and I can't you see and the building things prior to this was long. I don't really think I made much of a contribution on buildings. I helped some, and I.
You went to some of the meetings.
Oh, I went.
Campus Planning
Committee. Oh, yes, I was a member.
I know you were, but I don't think you always had to go to meetings. I mean, you could have sent.
In that den of thieves, I had to be there. I cared enough to want to make sure the college was represented. Yeah. Yes, indeed, but I wouldn't say that I made a very large contribution.
Well, Leo Jacobson said that he had to fight sort of on behalf of LMS.
Mm-hmm.
Both you and Mark Ingram
mm-hmm.
were against people like Croker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you need somebody else to, some impartial person to run interference for you, isn't that
bad? Yeah. Do you remember him?
Oh, sure, very well. This Leo was really one of the best minds we had around here.
Uh-huh.
Oh, he had a concept of what a university ought to be.
Do you remember that, the sketch plan?
Oh, yes, indeed. I was always very kind about Leo. In fact, when he was in Calcutta, I went out of my way to visit him. He's kind of back, but he had a good influence because he tried to see the thing whole, and he had some ideas. Yeah.
That was my feeling, but I heard other people say other things, or that he was too
arbitrary sometimes.
And
intolerant and so on. Oh hell, to push. When you have a concept, it's a good one, a strong one. Everybody's trying to cut it apart here and there and chisel it off, and sometimes you have to keep strong. I think that these problems in some people's, I think they may confuse that period with the period when he was chairman of the department, where apparently there were some problems.
Well, and then when he was as a faculty member in the early 70s.
But I remember him very warmly.
Do you have any idea whether he was, he left voluntarily or was sort of hedged out?
I don't know. I would have guessed voluntarily. Didn't he go off to India?
Yes.
That's where he went, I think. Excitement of a chance to go off with Ford.
That would
be my guess. Now, and after that, Bob Fleming brought Edsel here. Was there somebody in between?
There was a man named Kinney here.
Oh, yes. He was a failure, sort of. Bill Kinney.
Which was a pretty bad time. You look to me as if you're getting tired of this.
I used to have lunch every once in a while with Mayor Dodd. Soglin is a much more charming person, much pleasant to have lunch with than Dyke was.
He's a very charming person, isn't
yes,
he, Soglin?
He is.
I've interviewed him. He's
yes. If he can get separated from some things here, he'd do very well in this world. I think he's a little bored.
Yeah.
Get off the tired of that city council ball and all that crew.
Well, still he's young and he has
yes.
a chance.
And he's got something he's bright. And he's got his personality. Yes, I kind of admired him. I've seen him under some very trying circumstances. Mr. Johnson handled himself very well. The state things were sporadic. Remember, my first two or three years, most of my state dealing with the state was dealing with National Guard investigations of why there were so many radicals on campus. A determination by a man named Clouser, who was still around, to take the police away from the university and put them under Bill Emery. These are the kind of issues. They were crisis issues. Warren Knowles was very supportive. Kyle Thompson was great. He was on that committee to investigate the university that somebody cooked up, and before he sort of steered the questions around and all can disappear like that. Getting quite remarkable.
Well, it was very important to have that list. But
yeah.
There's, I mean, this administrator, how I would be, I mean, maybe you just want to say a sentence or two about him, I would have, I guess, asked you about some of the decisions they've made in the State Building Commission, but you've not done very much with them, is that it?
At that moment, sometimes, I'd call Fred or go see somebody, routinely. Fred was always helpful. He's always been very helpful to the university. We've had Carol Thompson, Fred Risser, Mary Lou Montz, Mitch Miller, Everson, O'Malley, and Norm Anderson, very helpful. One of the greatest blows we ever had in Cap Times. They did him in. And we lost a great friend in the legislature.
The mayor hasn't...
Well, he doesn't have the stature or leadership position. Norm was the speaker.
Yeah.
And he could... He could make sure we got a fair hearing on everything and do things quite different, interesting. But it's been very, very good. I never had much dealings with Klarenbach or, but I, by and large, I think he votes what he thinks the university's interest. Sometimes he and I would have a different view of what that is, but I mean.
Perpetual point of view about the university.
Yes. But, no. And so I was, you know, I was in and out of there for many years and one thing and another. I remember the first time I appeared before the, was I think it was 1948, before the Joint Finance Committee. Gaylord Nelson was a member of it.
Oh.
So I've been, you know, in and out for a long time.
Oh, I see, yeah.
For a long time. Don't, never regarded myself as terribly influential, but when we had something concerning the university, we could always get somebody to listen to us. But I think particularly during the 69-70 period, when we had Clauser and Freilich and some other people really determined that we were soft and that we should be put under regimen of Bill Emery's. I was pretty active in that period. We just squeaked through that one. Then we had, there was this investigating committee when that was all through. That was large, Carol Thompson had a lot to do with that. Making that, you know, making sure the right questions got asked. On the legislative, during this period, George Field, Fred Harrington's period, which was downtown for Fred a good deal.
I've heard his name.
He's a chancellor at River Falls.
Oh.
And he's a person that you might want to talk to.
Okay. You know, that's another thing, is people that whose names don't crop up so often or don't or stand out. Who do a lot for the university. I don't know, Warren Exo, somebody has said that he was very important for the University of Downtown.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, I think.
Wally Lemon.
Wally Lemon, I would.
A lot of continuity. And Bob Clodius was downtown a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Young was very, very influential. Extraordinary, probably. Most influential in a period when we were having great success.
Was he, what was his position? You said he was
well,
to do with finance.
He was a budget officer. He was a
budget officer
and also sort of represented, he did budget and went downtown both.
Did he replace Peterson?
No, Peterson was vice president for finance, but